There's no outlines tonight, and I was debating putting one together, but I decided not to. My plan for this evening was to share encouragements and kind of a recap of a conference I went to yesterday at Central Seminary. And I wasn't sure what to expect at the conference. The conference was essentially living under an ungodly nation, living under ungodly rule, how to honor God while living under difficult circumstances like that. And when I initially looked into the conference, I was excited because I wasn't sure what to expect. And then a little later, they kind of filled out the itinerary, and it was focused on that there was life under communism, and it looked to me more like a historical sketch of experiences of faithfulness of Christians under the communist regime during the Cold War. And I wasn't sure what exactly we would get. I was excited to go and hear, but I must tell you, I was blessed and encouraged for a number of ways. And I want to basically, I want to look at a little bit of 1 Peter tonight, where he talks about suffering there. But I wanted to tell you, kind of share some of the stories, because the conference, the speaker was a man by the name of Manfred Kober, who has been a professor for years and has he's taught at Faith Baptist Bible College, I believe, an amazing testimony of just a life and his stories of faithfulness. What I can say is that to summarize the presentation, and I want to kind of just give you some of those snippets of those stories, is that through the testimony of this man and his family and those around him, starting from the 1930s going forward, it was amazing to hear stories that you've not heard before, at least I had not heard before, of confidence in God's promises during times of severe, difficult persecution, and a confidence particularly in God's promises made to the Jewish people. So the first kind of section that I want to kind of review, and this is, again, recounting yesterday's sessions. The speaker was born, I believe, he was about 5 years old when World War II ended in Europe. So he was born in the, 1940-ish, somewhere in there. And probably 1939 or 1940. And a significant part of his sharing of life under the persecution or under difficult government was life under Nazi Germany. And as a five-year-old, because Nazism or Germany was defeated when he was still a little boy, so his testimony of faithfulness there centered around his grandfather, whose name was Hermann Wolf. And just to cut a little bit of the story of this, because it's helpful, Manfred said his family, going back on his mother's side, was a Christian family born into Christian believing in a Baptistic, or actually Methodist back then, but they were would be those who would have had an evangelical faith in our language today. That was a tradition and the religious beliefs of their family. And his father, again, his one who was an adult living through the horrors of World War II as an adult, he served in World War I as a company cook and was glad that he wasn't in the fighting, but he was in World War I. And the story of this man's life is one of faithfulness, but also of tragedy and of risk-taking for the Lord. So this is the speaker's grandfather. While he was at war, his wife died, leaving five children without a mother and a father who was out at the war. As he returned home, he married another woman who, quote, was very kind to the children. But unfortunately, his second and his third wife both died within fairly quick succession of remarriage. He was, as his grandson describes him, as an old-time Methodist, but as not just a cultural Christian, but as someone who I think would fit into the categories of evangelical Christian. And he contrasted his mother's father with his father's father. His grandfather was a religious man. He was on the board of his own German Lutheran church, but as he described, he was not a godly man. He loved him as a grandfather. He was a nice man, but he wasn't a good man. He recounted this story of his two grandfathers sitting in a barn talking, and he said he was listening where he probably shouldn't have been listening. And this is probably near the end, after World War II. So the man for his dad had served in World War II and was missing in action, likely killed in the last days of the war by the Russians. And that was an interesting thing, too. He kept on bringing up that a lot of the German men fighting in the army, the regular army, were conscripted. You know, and that's always important to remember when we think about a lot of battles and things, the good side or the bad side or whatever else you have. It's never as black and white or cut and dry when you come down to an individual level in that regard. But moving on, they had both had sons, or, you know, families, and obviously Manfred's father would not return from the war, but his two grandpas were sitting in this barn speaking. And his father's father had seven sons, four who were grown and were married with children. All four served in the war, and none of them returned. So he lost four sons. And his comment that he remembered hearing his father's father say, he says, "Don't tell me there's a God when he does that to me." And then his mother's father said, "Did God start the war, or did Hitler? Are the German people to blame for what is now happening upon them? How we dare not blame his tragedies on God." Just a difference in the way in which the two men handled similar circumstances. One man was embittered and angry and couldn't believe in a God who would do these things to me. And another man who had gone through similar tragedies, similar hardships, had a Job-like response of, "Can we blame God?" And the answer is no. Now, he said, Nazism in those days, in his memory, was coming to a close, but not with a, he said, in a cursory fashion. He related this story. This is important to paint kind of the culture of, he remembers looking out his window onto the street where he saw, he must have looked because it was a couple of cars were screeching down the road, and they stopped quickly, and several Gestapo, because he lived in Germany, obviously, at the time, and got out of the car and came into this apartment building, and they dragged out this woman, about a 30-year-old woman, and drug her out and hauled her away in a police car. And 3 weeks later, her mother was told that her daughter had died of a heart attack, although later she found out that she was poisoned. And the reason why she was taken away is that she had said some unflattering things about Hitler in her own apartment when someone had been listening by the door. And someone in the apartment had informed on her, and she was taken away. He also spoke, Manfred did, about knowing there was a family across the street who were slower, mentally slower, who also disappeared. So as a child, he noted these things, and I'm sure the adults had more of an understanding of something bad was going on. People were disappearing, but you know, he said that the in his town, they didn't have a concept like we do of what was going on at the time. But so this is, I think, paints again a real life picture of the courage of the Christian man, Hermann Wolf, which again was really encouraging. So in the beginning or early, and even before World War II, there was this really heightened persecution of the Jews. And following Kristallnacht, which is this historical event where there was random violence, sporadic across Germany on Jews, which was not random. The Jews were continually isolated and segregated, so much so that they were forced into basic poverty because they couldn't get jobs and no one would want to buy their stuff because there was this isolation. Quoting from the presentation, he said, "The reason Hitler waged a very, in those days, Hitler waged a very, very vicious campaign against the Jewish people. First, they had to identify themselves with a yellow star with the word Jew written on it. And they lost their businesses, and they lost every means of livelihood. I learned years later that because the Jewish people were unable to get employment and food for themselves," he says, "my grandfather and his brother-in-law helped the Jewish people. As Christians who love the Jews, they went to their homes and deposited handfuls of money in their mailboxes so they'd go out and buy something to eat. Those Jewish people probably never knew where the money came from. My grandfather felt that we as Christians had an obligation to God's chosen people." He said later on, "My grandfather helped the local Jewish people whenever he could, often without anyone knowing his altruism. I don't think even my mother knew much of that. Not until years later did his sister Martha tell me that her husband and my grandfather would go to Jewish homes under cover of darkness with handfuls of money and put them anonymously in their mailboxes. So the Jewish people might have suspected where the money came from, but they never knew." He said later on that my relatives told me that his grandfather predicted that Hitler might as well give up. This is in the early days of the war. That he said he has lost the war before he began it because he's touching the chosen people. Now, I'm sure, and as he painted the picture, this was a bold thing to say in the early days, even prior to what we just understand as the breaking out of World War II. And again, these statements said by family, you know, relatives who were around and heard these things is an interesting thing. He said his grandfather would quote, refer to Deuteronomy 32:10 or Zechariah 2:8, which referred to the Jewish people as the pupil or the apple of his eye. And he recounted this other story that is reminiscent of, at least, it made me think of the Underground Railroad in the United States. He says this, now this is his memory, his own memory when he was a child. "I remember having Jewish people in our home," because they lived together as a family with his grandfather. "They shared our humble meal at dinner time. He never introduced them to us, and we didn't ask why, because we knew." Now, the reason why is because if he didn't know their names, he couldn't say who they were to be able to then inform on them and whatever else. So there was this language of plausible deniability. He said, "One of our pastors wrote an article about a situation that happened in our church. He mentioned coming to our house and finding us just sitting down to eat a meal. My grandfather hospitably invited the pastor to join our meager portion. He said, where four can eat, five can also eat. However, there were many people there at that time. And as the pastor bid us farewell, he said, but I never got to meet Mr. Waiting for his grandfather to introduce him to the guests, my grandfather stopped him short and said, I know what you want to know. He's a friend. He's a Jewish friend. He's not the first Jewish friend we've had in our house, and he's not going to be the last Jewish friend in our house. We want him to have a decent meal." And this pastor in that article wrote just a short time after, and I'm quoting the presentation. He said, "I admonished Hermann Wolf that he was putting his life at risk and that of his whole family. And Hermann Wolf said, greater is he that is in us than he is in the world. The Nazis were motivated by Satan, but he felt, speaking of his grandfather, who's doing the work of God, and God was in sovereign control over men and over the fears of men, so he was fearless from the start." He told also of, essentially, after feeding the family, they would hide out in his basement, kind of this closet of their bomb shelter, until nighttime, and then they'd flee. It's an amazing story. Another part of this, kind of going into all this testimony, this testimony of faithfulness during the time of the Nazi rule, there was this tradition in their church, and they're probably the churches in the area. They had a New Year's Eve service where there was a time for public praise, which would probably be something akin of, here's what God has taught me this year, or here's what I've learned, or in, you know, those kinds of things. And very often, his grandfather would get up every year. He would always do this and share something, and he'd end his praise time by quoting a stanza of a hymn that translated from German, which was not from me. This was the Manfred translated this. The stanza says this: "The greatest treasures I possess are those received from the Son of God, because the treasures of this world are false pretense and count for naught." Now, people may have thought, "Oh, that's a sweet thing to say. You know, that's a nice churchy thing to say." But again, as he was recording this, talking about his grandfather, he said, he heard one, this was years later, someone said, "Did you know that in 1938 or 39, your grandfather got up in that testimony meeting?" Again, 38, 39 is well in the time of Hitler's control. And he said something to defend the Jewish people. And he said, "I didn't know this." And so he said, "Your grandfather got up from his seat and gave one quotation of the scriptures, John 4:22, which says, 'Salvation is from the Jews.' And he sat back down." And I don't know all of the workings there, but he said the pastor canceled those services for the rest of the war, and because I'm sure that would get people in trouble. And again, after sharing his praise or testimony, he would end with that stanza. Now, one of the last times that he witnessed this, Manfred witnessed this from his grandfather, before he moved, was able to escape Germany after the, you know, during the Cold War, he said his mother had died on Christmas Eve of 1950. And so on New Year's Eve of 1950, no one expected his grandfather to get up and speak. But he did. And included words from Job: "The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And he closed with the same hymn of the stanza, which is again painting the picture of a man who was faithful to the Lord. Now, when it comes to the danger, again, the danger was real. The Lord protected, and during the presentation, he shared a lot of stories of God's providential protection from bombs falling from the Americans and the Russians and the Germans. Not the bombs from the Germans, but the Germans. So bombs from the Americans and the pillaging from the Russians and all kinds of things. It was a terrible time. He told a story of kids playing with live ammunition and like taking a hammer and setting off the thing, and just dangerous thing for a 5 and 9 year old to do, apparently. But I mean, anyway, so a dangerous time. He told a story of the only time he can remember his grandfather ever being ungracious. I'll read this here. This was the pastor wrote it down, another pastor, actually a relative, I believe. That there was this woman who came to visit. This is between World War II, and this is after World War II, so it's in the time of Russia's dominance in West and kind of East Germany. A former police commander's wife, Mrs. Mueller, came and wanted his grandfather to sign this document stating that her husband had treated him humanely because he didn't send him to an extermination camp. And his grandfather, he's relating this. The pastor comes in and he says, "Did I sin? Here's what I did. I told the woman to get out. If I had dogs, I'd sick them on you," to the woman who was asking to do this. And the pastor said, "You'd have been wrong to sign that paper. It was not wrong to respond to that in such a harsh way to an unrepentant, wicked request." And lest you think that he was maybe responding, maybe that guy did have a kind regard for him, he said after the Russians came in and kind of dismantled the city hall, they had one of their relatives was the mayor of the town, and he divulged, he says, there was this list of names that once the war was over, the great purging of the enemies within was going to be done by Hitler. And who was at the top of the list? Hermann Wolf and family. So had the war continued longer, or had there been a lull, or had Hitler won, he and his family, including the speaker yesterday, would have been executed. So just an amazing statement of, again, example of God, of living under harsh and ungodly government and the boldness. And I kind of tried to jot down three of the points that kind of stuck out to me from his presentation. The whole day, but kind of really codified in a testimony of his grandfather, that he was confident in God's power. The greater is he that is in you than he is in the world. They were confident that God was sovereign and in control, and that whatever happened was under God's in God's plan in that regard, and they didn't have to fear men because they had the God who was greater than all. Also confident in God's goodness, the idea, the understanding of the gospel, confident in the promises of God, to be able to stand in the face of such daunting fear of man opportunities, and then finally confident in God's promises to the Jewish people. Throughout the presentation, he'd reference, you know, both his own conviction and his grandfather's conviction that the promise that God made to Abraham, where he said, the one who blesses you, I will bless, and the one who curses you, I will curse. And that desire of some of the Christians in those in those days, in those places, to try to bless the Jewish people and to obviously look out for those who are being persecuted, but also particularly the Jews. He told stories too of life under communism. He said he was 12 years old. So I know Mariah, Aiden, probably 12 years old, going on a transatlantic trip from communist East Germany, spending a little time in West Germany, to across the Atlantic Ocean. Where you're supposed to, where everything's in English, you'll know English, to get to relatives on the other side. What a harrowing experience that would have been for a child. And just, I mean, to send someone on that trip with all of the, you know, dangers there. He said the last time he saw his grandfather actually was when he crossed from east to west. He got a special pass to get out because he had no parents. And somehow it was the way his family said, it must have been an error. Let's get him out quickly so they don't correct the error. But he got out. And then he made it his life's ambition for a while to go back on various opportunities to cross into the East with gospel literature. And he told us several different stories of aiding the church, particularly in Germany and in a larger Russian control, by bringing in literature. He told a couple stories of how he tried to, you know, smuggle in things or out things, and one he's trying to smuggle out a family heirloom that they wouldn't let him keep. He said, we had tea, I bought a lot of tea, and when they told me to rifle through my bag, I accidentally spilled tea everywhere, and so then they focused on the tea and then said to push me through, you know, instead of looking through my bag. He says that worked or whatever. And so, but bringing in books and things of that nature to various different individuals. He told one story, a sad story of, because he said that the secret police in Germany had infiltrated in the Christian church. And he told a story of when he was able to bring materials, there was this kind of hub where they in someone's house they could bring materials that would then be able to be distributed various places through you know, inside of the Russian dominated lands. And he told a story of going to the place, being let into the gate, and going into the garage and putting his materials, you know, in this garage. And there's other books and things around the garage, and talking with the gentleman and praying with them. And he turned up the radio to make sure that no one would hear them. And he made sure that there's all these kinds of ways to stop here, you know, to not be spied on. several years later, many, many years later, he learned that that individual who ran that kind of warehouse was a Stasi informant, actually cover agent, who essentially turned in the next day everyone who'd come to his house, and then turned in the people that he delivered things to. And the story, as is told in the book that he read, had this guy as one of the main characters, that in the prisons in Russia, they talk to the people who are in prison and say, "Do you know why you're here? Because of your friend in Berlin." And it was amazing because this was, again, as far as they could tell, there were very few, if any more, who were not turned in, as the speaker yesterday was not. But an unrepentant, vile betrayer, you know, brought many saints into jail and to worse, for sure, because of their trying to get gospel literature to Christians behind the Iron Curtain. He told a story of a pastor by the name of Pavel Negi in the Czech Republic. And he mentioned I'm skipping forward to a little bit here. I'll tell you the story. It'll fit in a little bit here. So in his trips, he would have to find, you know, places to kind of lodge and drop off materials. And one time he was in the Czech Republic, and he said he wanted to take whoever he was with to go on like a day to go to the beach or something, because, you know, you need to relax too. And so he called this local pastor, said, "Can we park our car in your driveway? Because if you parked it at a place, you'd come back." He said, "You'd no wheels, no windshield wiper blades, no engine. It'd be nothing. It'd be all gone." And so the pastor said, "Yeah, you can come park in our driveway." And he says that obviously someone was always marking down the license plates of anybody who came to that place, because people knew what was going on there as far as the pastor's house. He said he went away for the day with whoever he was with. I forget exactly. Came back, and he says that we got back, and he said the couple there staying with the elderly pastor and his elderly wife, he said they were so excited. And why are you so excited? He says, "It's all gone. All the literature you gave us is gone." What do you mean? Well, so he said there was a grocery store across the street. And whenever the delivery truck came on, he says, you never knew what they were going to deliver. You had no idea. So you got in line to get whatever they had, because that's all you get. So you brought your own bag. In communist China or communist Russia, you brought, in those days, you brought all your own bags. So they got in line, and the wife and the husband, the local pastor and his wife there, got in line, and they had their literature, their tracts in the local language. And they just started going up and down, asking somebody if they wanted the tract, and they drop it in their bag and got rid of all of them. And I should have looked up the person I was thinking of, but when he got back and sharing the story, Manfred, the speaker yesterday, said, "There's sure to have been informants in those lines there. Do you realize you put yourself in a lot of danger here?" And he said this is the pastor. He says, "I've served the Lord in a communist society for all these years. And how many years do you think I have left?" He's probably about 80 at the time. "And even if something happens to me, don't you think the Lord will make it worth my while? I'm so delighted I had those literature items to share with them." Reminds me of, I forget, the martyr said, 80 and 6 years I've served the Lord, how could I now deny him?" That was an amazingly powerful story. But again, just to, you know, I think I went to the conference, the lectures, looking for and desiring theological paradigms for forward looking into how to navigate life under despotic rule, if that is in store for us or our children or our grandchildren. And that would have been a very worthwhile conference. But I have to say that, again, though it was very different, and it was, again, much more of a conversational lecture or story time, which was very, very helpful and very informative. It was a blessing. He actually said that, I remember the Berlin Wall coming down. I remember kind of the news of that happening. But what I didn't know was that there had been, part of the story was there had been weekly prayer times of young people at this Lutheran church in Berlin. And apparently on the final night, the short story is a government minister got up and said that they were going to grant people the ability to get out of East Germany. The backside of the paper he was supposed to read said, if you apply for things and da-da-da-da-da. He forgot to read the backside. So there was this, from this event and other places, a mass marching towards the wall, and the guards on the wall called the commander who couldn't be reached, called the Russian commander who couldn't be, his car phone wasn't working, and finally called a lower-level official, you know, to say, what do we do? Because you know, the machine guns and all the things, they would have been a terrible deal. And the answer was, let him go. And that's the time when the Berlin Wall came down. And he weaved in this faithful regularity of prayer for this deliverance from this wicked regime. That I don't remember reading or hearing in current events or in later historical reviews of that. I'm sure it could be there. But it was an amazing, you know, just... He was involved with individuals throughout the area and had gone through the various expanding barricades and things that separated East from West. He has in his notes, he had a kind of a cross section of just the killing field that it was to get from East to West. I mean, fences, dog runs, minefields, automated guns that if you tripped a wire, you'd be shot everywhere from Sunday. And told of a story of a man from the West who was trying to take one of the emplacements out and tripped a wire, and he was no more. Just terrifying things. But it was amazing to hear, the encouraging stories of simple faith, simple trust in the Lord, in the face of real danger. I mean, the neighbor, 30-year-old young woman, taken away and never seen again. He told a story of his aunt who, I think in one of the stories, he referred to her as a large lady who was a Sabbath day's journey around, I think is what he said. Just as funny the way he describes his sweet aunt, you know, his great aunt, and how they had to hide in an outhouse from the American, essentially, strafing runs over his town. He said, at the end of the war, the Americans got some bad intel. There was German troops in his town, and there wasn't. So every day for weeks, they're bombing the town and shelling the town. And then before the army came in, they had this. The only thing I can compare it to is remembering like in Vietnam types of imagery with helicopters with the machine gunners on the side coming, flying through. And he said they just shoot anybody they would see. Of course, it wasn't helicopters; it was planes with machine guns on the side. And so you hid from them because you didn't want to get shot by the Americans. And so he hid from them, and he told a story of how a bomb that had not gone off had bounced through and just went through the bedroom of a neighbor, and even though it didn't go off, it killed everybody. And a bomb that didn't go off that landed in their basement. Just amazing stories of God's protection of their family. But he told of his aunt. Again, his great aunt, again, he left his whole family in Germany when he was able to get out. And he said later in life, she was, you know, moved into an old folks home. And he went back to visit her probably in the early 60s, again, on one of his trips back. And he wanted to go see his aunt. And he went to the church on Sunday. And he mentioned to his cousin, who's the pastor, I'm going to go see Aunt Frieda, I think is her name. And she died on Thursday. What? That can't be. She was healthy. I mean, she was a healthy woman. And the pastor said, yeah, I went to visit her on Wednesday, and she was starting to, you know, be less mentally with it, but she was healthy, and the next day she was dead. He says, I can't prove it, you know, but it would make sense because she had a history of this Frida. When she was in the home, she would go to, when she was on having a good day, she'd go door to door on her level and share the gospel with people. He said that when he was a kid, he used to go play in the snow and then Frida would bring him into the house and warm him up, you know, and put an iron on his feet to warm him up. And then he said, then she'd torture me for half an hour by reciting Christian poems and scripture. She'd torture him with that. And anyway, so that was what she would probably do going throughout the home. Well, that wasn't liked by the German communist people, so they put her on the fourth floor where there was very few people and she couldn't do stairs. So, you know, no proving it, but it would not surprise them if she was given a lethal injection of something when one day she's healthy, the next day she's not. So anyway, just a lot of different stories. And so just to kind of, we looked at 1 Peter chapter 4 a little bit. So if you turn there, I'd like to do that, look at that briefly tonight. And again, it wasn't a exegetical conference. It was more of the faithful in application. But as you're turning to chapter 4, we need to remember that in 1 Peter 2 and Romans 13, we're commanded to submit to the Lord, to government for the Lord's sake. But the obvious, there are obvious times when the government steps outside of its realm of authority, steps outside of its jurisdiction, and commands those things that God has forbidden, or forbids those things that God has commanded. And those are times in which we are to not obey their commands. I'm not even thinking about the connection about this. We in our youth group a couple weeks ago, we talked about this a little bit, and I asked the question. We're talking about honoring authority, and I asked the question to the youth group. I said, "Who's a spiritual authority in your life?" And they looked at me. Okay, good. So, should you, if the pastor says something, ought you to listen and respond in proper, I don't think I use the word obedience, but should you do what he says? Well, yeah, you should, of course. So I said, Darcy. I said, so Darcy, what if I told you had to, if you're going to buy a new car, and I said you had to buy a gray Nissan truck, that's the car you have to buy, should you obey what I say? Now, sweet, Darcy said, well, I'd want to know why you said that, which is a sweet thing to say. My answer is, you don't need to obey what I say. I have no authority over what car you buy. I've stepped outside of my realm of your authority and telling you things that aren't mine to tell you. So, two, when it comes to examining and careful to honor the authorities over us, when they've transgressed those boundaries and giving us orders they have no right to give us, then we have the ability to not obey. But in the context of the series yesterday, of the lectures yesterday, he was looking at 1 Peter chapter 4. So just look at verses 12 and following with me. It says this: Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you. But to the degree that you share in the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing, so that also at the revelation of his glory you may rejoice with exultation. If you are reviled for the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests on you. Make sure that none of you suffers as a murderer or thief or evildoer or a troublesome meddler. But if anyone suffers as a Christian, he is not to be ashamed, but is to glorify God in this name. For it is time for judgment to begin with the household of God. And if it begins with us first, what will be the outcome for those who do not obey the gospel of God? And if it is with difficulty that the righteous is saved, what will become of the godless man and the sinner? Therefore, those who suffer according to the will of God shall entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. And he had a very simple outline as he was walking through that. I don't know if it was his originally, but I thought this was, again, just an encouraging thing as you look at First Peter chapter 4, first of all, verse 12, suffering is commonplace. Don't be surprised. As a matter of fact, Paul says, those who walk in Christ will be persecuted. I mean, the helpful reminder for us, for me, for you, is that we are living in a unique abnormality of time. And not that the hardships that we have in our society for the gospel are nothing, but it is uniquely distinct that it is not harder and worse for us. So we are not to be surprised at the persecutions. And Peter was talking about the persecutions under Rome, which were killing Christians because they're Christians. Don't be surprised at them. So, number one, suffering is commonplace. And then verse 13, his statement was, suffering will be compensated. Now, keep on rejoicing. But the degree that you share in the sufferings for Christ, keep on rejoicing. So that also with the revelation of his glory, you may rejoice with exaltation. This reminder that there will be this well done, good and faithful servant. Well done for those who walk in faithfulness to Christ and those who suffer for his sake. And that's the story where he kind of weaved in the story about the Czech Republic pastor who said, what can they do to me? I'm glad those tracks are gone. Thirdly, he said in verse 14, suffering is commendable. If you are reviled for the name of Christ, you are blessed because the Spirit of glory and of God rests on you. And again, in the context of non-abstraction, suffering for Christ or reviled for Christ could mean the end of your livelihood and the inability to feed your family. Now, that is not anything that any person, any man, would take lightly. I have an obligation to feed my family. That I have that duty to God. But if faithfulness to Christ results in my inability to do that because of persecution, well, then we are blessed in God. So suffering is commendable in verse 14, and then verse 15 and 16, suffering is Christ-like. Suffering is Christ-like. In other words, when you suffer as a Christian and you have no reason to be ashamed. Because when we suffer for what is right and true, we bear the witness of Christ in our suffering and in our life. We show to those who are persecuting us, those who are around us, who Christ is and that he can be trusted. Just thinking about his grandfather saying, in the heart of Nazi Germany, not only is the statement of Hitler's going to lose this war because he started with the Jews, but also in the church service, in the height of it still, salvation is from the Jews, when that is a verboten thing to say and a terrible thing because that is all kinds of social bad. Amazing, amazing pictures, again, of the suffering, of the hardships. And though his story spoke of, obviously his grandfather didn't die under the Nazis, wasn't killed by the Russians. His great aunt might have been, but others were. You know, it's the Esther. If I die, I die. It's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. God can save us, but if he doesn't, it's not going to change it. It's that kind of courage. And many were sawn in two. Many were fed to the lions. Many did not walk through that unscathed. It's the confidence that suffering for Christ is, it honors him and it shows to the world Christ's own love and care and sacrifice. And he said further, for the last point of verse 17 and 18, suffering is conditioning. thinking about, again, the refining process that our suffering takes us. Finally, verse 17 and 18. This is the refining process. That our hardships are for refinement. The hardships of the ungodless are for their destruction. And then finally, suffering is consoling. Therefore, also those who suffer according to the will of God shall entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. We can have that consolation of not knowing all the things, but we know our Creator who does what is right. So again, while I wasn't, it wasn't maybe what theologian, pastor, looking to future application me wanted to have as a day-long seminar, encouraged by the faithfulness of people that I had never heard of before, in situations that I have never been in, was encouraging. And again, the simple faith, and I don't mean that in any derogatory, the simple, plain faith of common Christians who knew their God and knew what was right and trusted Him. And his story is of those who mostly came out and God walked them through the danger. We know many others did not. So it was an encouraging time. And again, hopefully this was an encouraging, just a summation for you all of the testimony of faithful Christians in the times of communism and in the time of Nazism, and that God's gracious protection against all odds, all of man's odds, I should say, and even Allied bombs and Russian infantrymen, all the things that God cares and has a plan for each individual, even a 5-year-old boy running on the street. Well, I'm going to close this in prayer and we can have a time of fellowship. Heavenly Father, thank you so much for all that you have done for us. Thank you for the testimonies of faithful saints who lived in places and times that we don't, and spoke languages that we don't, had hardships and miseries that we cannot fathom, endured privations that we do not experience, witnessed horrors that we can only but imagine, and yet remained faithful. May we be faithful in our day and age. May we not slink back from the looks, from the legislation, from the things in our culture that do look at and treat faithful Christians in a way that is unfavorable. May we not be so easily pushed off our trust in you. May you give us grace for the time that we're in, and grace abounding even more when those needs and those dangers are stronger, that we might be faithful. But might we know you and trust in you with a simple, true faith that greater are you than anyone else in this world, and that what you have said we can count on, and that you will care for us now and in the future, up to and through our death. In Christ's name, amen.